This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here with David Canfield, who interviewed our subject for this week's interview episode. Hi, David.
Hello.
David, I'm jealous that you got to do this interview because you pitched it first. But I think all of us would have really jumped ahead of each other in line to talk to Melanie Lynskey for what to me feel like obvious reasons, because she is delightful. But you guys talked about much more than her charming personality.
We did. This was the third time I've spoken to her in not that long ago time period, because she's been in a lot of things and she's had a lot to talk about. It's been really exciting to see her have the year she's had. And we got to talk about Yellow Jackets, which she's incredible in and will be a big Emmy contender for, and also the upcoming Candy, which premieres May 9th on Hulu.
Yeah, in the piece that you wrote that accompanies this interview, which people can read on VF.com, you got secondary quotes from Leonardo DiCaprio in addition to her Candy co-star, which really is really strong evidence of what a great 6 months she's had, because she was in Don't Look Up before all of this. And as you wrote about, and I'm sure you talk about, like, it has just been a long, steady career to get to this, what now feels like she's suddenly everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, she's co-stars with Leonardo DiCaprio in Don't Look Up, of course. They play husband and wife. And I thought about it because her first role was in Heavenly Creatures opposite Kate Winslet.
Of course.
And, you know, Melanie Lynskey's been working very steadily since then, but obviously two different career paths from there. But she's had a lot of work that, as she talks about in the interview, hasn't been that widely seen, that she's really proud of. And she's reached this point kind of suddenly where a lot of people are paying attention to her. And that means more interviews. That means more anecdotes to share, and more of a spotlight, which she's not too used to.
Yeah, and people are surely familiar with Yellow Jackets at this point. It premiered on Showtime late last year. But Candy is coming up, and obviously you're not going to want to spoil it too much. It's based on a real story. It's a little bit of a murder mystery in some ways. But you and I have both watched some of it, and I really want people to watch it, even if they feel burned out on murder. So is there anything people should know about Candy before they hear this conversation?
One of the things that excites me the most about it is the way it's being released. It's being released one episode a night over 5 nights, culminating in Friday the 13th. And the show will help explain why it's culminating on a Friday the 13th. But it feels like an event series in a way we haven't had in a long time. It's an older model of releasing, particularly miniseries. And it feels like the right format for a show like this. And the other thing I'd mention is that while it is a true crime show, one of many premiering this spring, it comes from a writer, Robin Veith, who has her roots in Mad Men and very, very schooled in old school prestige episodic drama. And I think brings a lot of that flair to the show, which is still under embargo, so we can't say too much.
But, let it whet your appetite.
Yes, it's got a lot of good people involved, including Melanie Lynskey.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's hear your conversation with the delightful Melanie Lynskey.
Well, I'm very excited to chat with you today because we have two projects to talk about. Let's start by talking about Candy. You said this one's very meaningful to you. You said that when Vanity Fair did the first look for the show. So to start, can you talk a little bit about why it's meaningful to you?
When I read the script for the first time, I felt very connected to Betty. I think I was a very shy, awkward child who had a really hard time making friends. I never knew what the right thing to say was, and I really saw that in her. And we talked to this lovely man who wrote a book about the case, and he said that everybody he talked to said that she just was awkward. She just had a difficult time. And, you know, she's from Kansas. She moves to Texas with all these big outgoing personalities around her. And I just related. I'm from a small town in New Zealand, and I moved to Los Angeles as a young woman. And I was like, what am I doing? How am I supposed to be? And so that aspect of her just really moved me, and I understood it.
What kind of research do you like doing for parts like this? Obviously, Betty was a real person. This was a real horrific thing that happened to her. You've played characters based on real people before. I imagine this one was a unique kind of challenge in that regard.
Yeah, it was. This is the first time I've played a real person who was not with us anymore. Yeah, and it was complicated. I mean, I wanted to be respectful of her memory, but I also didn't want to completely sugarcoat it. I didn't want to make her just sort of like the sweet victim, because that's not what people said about her. She was a very complicated person, and the script showed that. So I wanted to just really be true to who she actually was, like the whole woman that she was. But, you know, I didn't have many opportunities. I did talk to the journalist who had talked to so many people who knew her, but obviously I didn't get a chance to talk to her family members or anything. And you feel a particular kind of responsibility in situations like this.
It makes me think a little bit about your career as well, that kind of advocacy for the character. For a long time, and still to an extent today, Hollywood lacked interest in women like Betty. And that's something you have spoken about and you've had to push against for a long time. Did you feel that kind of connection with that relationship to this character and advocating for someone who got to be a lead? I've seen a few episodes now, and she is really beautifully fleshed out. And it's refreshing to see someone like Betty get that kind of depth and nuance and prickliness at times as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a lovely way to put it. Yeah, I really did. And part of her actual story was that she didn't fit into the kind of popular girl mold that I've never fit into as an actress. And when Candy was on trial for her killing, a lot of what they were talking about was, oh, Betty was a bigger woman than her, and could Candy possibly have overtaken her? Would she have been strong enough? Because she was right. So, you know, they did this awful thing in court that isn't in the show, but they made a kind of larger sized woman stand up in court. And they said, is your body kind of like Betty Gore's? And, you know, it's like a horrible and demeaning for both women. But there was all this stuff that they did around her body. And then also just, she wasn't very popular, and that became part of Candy's defense. She just wasn't this like beautiful, confident person. And yes, I did very much relate to that. And I just, I thought it was so wonderful how the show was equally interested in both women.
Yeah. It's something that surprised me a great deal was I'd seen the first one, and that's kind of, without spoiling too much, the lead up to the killing, which is seen very much through Candy's perspective. How much did you know going into the show about the way that that was going to turn on its head a little bit and give Betty that equal kind of almost agency in the story? Obviously, I'm sure you knew given that you signed on, but what was that aspect of discovery like for you?
I read all the scripts before I signed on. Honestly, I think Robin is so brilliant, and I'd worked with Michael Appendale before, who directed episode 1 and episode 5, and I just love working with him. He's so great. So I was already kind of sold, but of course you need to read the script and see if it's something that makes sense to you and something that feels like something that I can embody, because sometimes, you know, something's good, but I just don't have it in me for whatever reason. So it was really nice to read the scripts and see her coming into her own a little bit more. The story sort of shifting from Candy's story to Betty's story, and then the final episode is very much Candy's story again. It's literally Candy telling the story.
I noticed you were doing interviews for about how big Yellow Jackets was getting while you were filming Candy. So you have, on the one hand, going from one very intense murdery show to another back to back, and you and I spoke a little bit about that previously. But I'm also wondering about the other element. Knowing this piece you'd done was getting a level of attention that was really exciting and that you maybe weren't used to. While you were filming Candy, did that feel kind of encouraging? Was there maybe an intimidating element? I'm just curious what that experience was like for you.
It was all of the above. It was encouraging. It was intimidating. It was very much something I'm not used to. I'm used to doing things and having a few people say, oh, I love that thing that you did. And then slowly over the years, two or three more people a year will be like, oh, I managed to catch that. You know, it was right on Amazon. I mean, people I haven't heard from in years getting in touch with me. And then I started to do some interviews, and then what I was saying in the interviews, people were paying attention to. It was really odd.
Yes.
Odd place to be for me. I was like, oh gosh, I've got to start watching myself because I have no filter. But it was also really nice and really gratifying. And there was something very exciting for me to know that I was working on something that was so different, a character that was so different from Shauna at the same time as Yellow Jackets was coming out. Yeah. I was like, this feels good. This feels like a good sort of next thing to be doing.
I imagine it was probably nice that you were busy during that time, too, that it wasn't just this happening in kind of vacuum, where you were left to sort of do all these interviews and get all this attention and not maybe not know what to do with it exactly.
Yeah, it was kind of nice. But then, like, on a practical level, I've never been asked to do a talk show before. No one's ever been interested. I'd like auditioned once for Craig Ferguson, like his talent booker, and I failed.
So no!
They were like, she asked too many questions about me. The interviewer said she needs to learn how to tell an anecdote. And I was like, oh God, failed. But that was the closest I'd ever come to being on a talk show. And then suddenly it's like, do you want to go do this thing? Do you want to go do that thing? And I wasn't allowed. Like, Candy was just like, the production was just like, nope, sorry. So I wasn't allowed to go and do any of these things. You know, I'm 44.
That's a good point.
It's exciting.
Yeah,
I couldn't go to the premiere of Don't Look Up. There was a lot. Yeah, so it was nice to be busy. I'm always, always grateful to be working above anything else. But at the same time, I was like, ah.
You can spin a hell of an anecdote, Melanie Linsky. I don't know what Craig Ferguson's talent booker was talking about.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. I don't know. I was trying to have a conversation, I guess, which is not the way to do it.
I personally appreciate that. And not everyone does that, so I'll leave it at that.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
You're someone who engages with critics, I'd say, more than most at your level in this profession. I'm biased, but I find that incredibly refreshing. And I was curious about that part of your relationship to making movies and TV. I saw you're someone who subscribed to movie magazines and really loves and grew up loving the art form. Can you talk a little bit about that side of it for you?
It's just something that I've always loved. I loved reading movie magazines from the time I was kind of a young teenager. And then when Heavenly Creatures was coming out, I think I was 17, and Miramax said, "Do you want us to fax you the reviews of Heavenly Creatures?" I've never felt fancier in my life getting, you know, faxes sent to my dad's office of these reviews from some were people I'd never heard of and some were people I already respected from the magazines that I read. But there's something about like reading people describe something you worked on so hard in a way that is universal and resonant and poetic and moving. It felt huge to me to have people take that kind of time to write about my work. I just was like, I don't understand why people don't read reviews. I don't understand. It's just like, it felt amazing. And I've always had kind of a thick skin, so I don't mind literal criticism. There were some things that weren't super nice about my physical appearance. I was like, well, that's the character I was playing. And then there have been times over the years where I know I've given a performance that hasn't been that good for whatever reason. And when I've seen somebody kind of call that out, I've had a ton of respect for that critic. It's really, I just think it's kind of like a magic trick. I just think it's incredible. Especially when a film festival is happening, people can come out and tweet something that encapsulates their response to a movie. Or write a review that night that's published the next day. It's crazy, crazy to me. So I feel like I'm like such a fangirl of so many critics. And thank you for being nice about it, because sometimes I'm like, am I annoying? Am I like kind of wannabe like engaging with these people who I have so much respect for? But thanks for being nice about it.
Oh, it feels the opposite to me. It feels like, I mean, I'm not going to go off on a tangent here, but, you know, we do sometimes work in a bit of a vacuum and we do engage with work pretty deeply or try to. And it's always nice when not only it's heard, but there can be a bit of a back and forth. You've never felt, you mentioned when you got Heavenly Creatures reviews at 18, you're like, why do people read reviews? Have you ever had a feeling since then of maybe I do need to take a step back from this kind of engagement?
I think after Hello, I Must Be Going, which is a movie I did that came out in 2012, there were a couple of reviews that I found hurtful and I didn't really agree with. They were sort of, it's difficult because I was having an affair in the movie with a younger man. And I think a male reviewer is going to put himself in the young man's position. And there was a couple of reviews that just said like, oh, really? Would he really be attracted to her? And I think Chris Abbott, who was in the movie, and I had amazing chemistry, and I love the movie. I'm very proud of the movie. And so that was the only time I woke up in the morning and I started to read the reviews, and I was like, this was a mistake. I have to go do a whole day of press now, and I'm already bummed out. But you know, people have to bring their own individual perspectives to it, and that's how a couple of people felt. Overall, the response to that movie was so positive, but it's always the negative things that kind of stick with you, you know?
Always. You have received a lot of great reviews over the course of your career for a lot of things that, as you mentioned earlier, have not necessarily been widely seen. Has that fueled you in a way? What has that part of it meant to you? I think independent filmmaking, especially now, can be such a invisible art. And that really is where I think support can lie and continuation of it can happen.
Yeah. I mean, that's another reason I've been so grateful to critics, because people can often like champion a really small movie and take it a lot further than it would have gone otherwise, and write about it in a way that's really eloquent and beautiful. And certainly for some of my movies, people would do Q&As, like moderate Q&As and stuff like that, and go out of their way to help the movie be a bit more visible. And I really appreciate that. But it is always a little bit heartbreaking when you work so hard and you love something and it just kind of gets lost in the shuffle. There have been a few of those that I wish more people had seen.
Is there one that you would like to shout out now?
I mean, Hello, I Must Be Going, which I just talked about, is one
I love that
feel
movie.
Really proud. Oh, thank you. You saw it. That's so nice.
I saw it when it came out.
Oh. And I really love I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which is on Netflix, so people can...
It's right there.
People can find it on Netflix. It's right there. It's right there. That's another one that means a lot to me.
I heard you left 2.5 Men as a regular when you started to worry or just gather the level of exposure it could bring you. And that was your first regular role, right?
Yes. It was the first time I had ever made any money. It so wasn't like a ton of money. It was my first ever job on a television show. But yeah.
So it's a big decision to make.
It was a huge decision. And the people who were my agents at the time thought I was crazy. They thought I was absolutely crazy because it was going into season 3, which is when you're able to renegotiate and ask for more money. And they just thought I was nuts.
And it was huge.
It was huge. It was huge. But that was part of what was scaring me so much. Mm-hmm. You know, I signed on to the pilot as a guest star. And then you don't really know where it's going. And there were things I really liked about the show. And there were things that were not for me 100%, you know. Sure. And I also was the wacky neighbor. I did 2 seasons and I was like, this could be it. Like, it's very hard to get out of a decade of playing the wacky neighbor and not, you know, it's the sitcom schedule is so easy. You can't complain about the hours. It's so easy, but at the same time, you're doing, you know, 22 episodes and it's a lot of the year taken up. So I wasn't really able to do anything else. And I feel very grateful that Chuck Lorre listened to my concerns and let one of the regulars go and become recurring on a hit show. He didn't want that to happen. He didn't want anything to change, but he respected my request. So that was very nice.
You mentioned liking some things, not other things. How did you find acting and playing the beats of a network sitcom? It's a specific, I think, pretty exacting method of production, especially compared to indie film.
Yeah. There were things that I absolutely loved about it, like the audience response. There were a couple of times when the audience response was so intense that Charlie and I both teared up at the exact same minute. Huh. And there were some things that it's like surfing, kind of like you feel the joke coming and you play it and the audience, it's really, some things about it I found very magical. But then they don't want you to do anything different because the idea is that someone can turn the TV on and watch any episode of 2.5 Men over its entire run, and it doesn't really matter where in the show it was. So you have to kind of be pretty consistent. It doesn't give you much chance to... I mean, I felt very lucky because I was playing a character who was an absolute crazy person and a genius and a billionaire. So I got to do a lot of fun stuff within the parameters, but there are still parameters.
Yeah. So you get to Yellow Jackets, another popular show of yours. 20 or so years later.
Different, yeah.
Very different. But now that you've been in the industry for as long as you had by this point, what did it feel like seeing the show take off? It didn't happen immediately. It wasn't with, I wouldn't say it was with the pilot. And it's extremely hard to predict this kind of thing, as you know better than me. I'm curious, just set the scene for me. How did you sense it building? What was that process like for you?
I don't know. I think just people started to reach out to me. Like I said before, like people I hadn't heard from for a long time were just like, we're watching the show. We love the show. And a lot of people writing to me on Twitter. And then suddenly there were stories about the show, theories. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, oh, you should go look at Reddit. Like there's a Yellow Jackets Reddit board. And I did for a time.
Is there ever?
Yeah. And it was very intense. And then I saw how that was growing. And I just was like, oh my goodness, this is popular. It's very weird for me. I've never had an experience like this.
It's the kind of project that shatters a lot of thinking that went into Hollywood. historically, mm-hmm. both in terms of how good it is and how big it got. Did that feel satisfying at all? Just seeing a show like this about teen girls' angst and living with a certain level of trauma and living through that just completely resonate on such a dramatic level and also just be really fucking good.
Yeah. Yes, it was so satisfying because I feel like there's this narrative in Hollywood that people don't want to see female-driven projects. People don't want to see, like, African-American-driven projects. And it's just proved to be wrong over and over again with the things that people choose to watch and the movies that people go see, box office results. Like, so again, I just sort of felt like, yeah, people do want to see women. People do want to see middle-aged women. There's an audience. And so I just hope more and more projects are made that are for this audience.
One of my favorite things about the way you play Shauna is in the layers. Peeled back episode by episode. Like, oh, yep, she can kill a guy and this is how it would look. I guess, spoiler alert. it's all online. Or, this is where we can see her be very particularly vulnerable and see why. It just feels so rich to watch, and it seems like it was the same way playing it to an extent.
Oh my gosh, so much. There's so much there, and I feel really grateful to the writers that they trusted me with so many exciting things. And the layers, like, I also feel like we're halfway through the layers. I feel like Shauna is somebody who's living so much in her trauma response that she hasn't even processed half of what's happening. I never got to have like a huge emotional moment. Like, I feel like she's still at the beginning of unraveling and trying to ravel it back up again. She's trying to keep things from falling apart. She's not being very successful, but it's exciting to me how far there is still left to go.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
You were pitched a big character arc when you signed on to play Shauna. And it's interesting. I've spoken with actors who love knowing everything coming up if given the choice, and others who'd prefer to stay really in the dark. I know you've said knowing what a character is thinking helps you a lot. How do you balance, I suppose, staying in the moment with having that kind of thing in the back of your head of where a certain scene or beat is going that we don't know about yet?
I think you can't help but be in the moment. If you're playing it honestly and you're in a scene with somebody who's also present, you're going to be in the moment. And I think that the writers initially were nervous about giving too much detail. Like, sometimes I would ask questions and it was like they were pitching me. They'd say, something big is happening and we can't wait for you to see it. And I would be like, no, that's not a real answer. I do need to know, because sometimes you can... If you have an awareness of something that's coming in two episodes, you can modulate the performance up until then. And I don't know, it's only helpful for me. I'm not like ever giving anything away or playing a secret. I don't think anybody would if they're a present actor.
I assume you'd done some television where that wasn't the case, where maybe you didn't know where everything was going. So you know what that contrast is like.
Yeah. And I didn't enjoy it. And there were times you get a script and it was quite soon before you had to shoot it. And you have questions narratively. Like, I'm probably a nightmare for writers, honestly, because I'm like, this thing doesn't add up. This plot point doesn't make sense when you consider this thing. Like, one of the writers of Yellow Jackets one day was like, boy, you like to keep us on our toes. And I was like, well, yeah, because people are going to be paying attention. And if I'm asking the question, people watching are going to be asking the question. And as it turns out, I was right. Because
there is no show where you could be more right.
Yeah. There are things where people have questions, and I had the questions too. And I think next season they're going to be like, okay, just tell us if you think something isn't, you know, A plus B is not like adding up here. Right. But yeah, I've been in that position before, and just it's been really hard for me to be playing a scene when I know some other thing has been established two episodes ago and now this doesn't make sense, but here I am having to perform it. It frustrates me.
I can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Another element I wanted to ask you about is you're anchoring with a couple other actresses, of course, a really large, excellent ensemble here. Particularly recently, you've been a part in smaller roles of big ensembles led by Cate Blanchett and Mrs. America, or DiCaprio mm-hmm. and Jennifer Lawrence on Don't Look Up. Is there some gathered wisdom there beyond the obvious? What have you found to making a group and on a project really click?
For me, something that I always appreciated, and honestly, it started on Ever After when I was part of a wonderful ensemble and Angelica Houston, who was the scariest cast member for me because I had so much respect for her.
Sure.
And she's quite imposing before you know her and you see that she's a gentle, lovely, kind, sweet angel. She made sure to reach out, include everybody, make sure everybody was okay. Say, if you have an issue, come to me. I'm here for you always. And I believed her. She meant it. So that's something that I try to do if I'm in that position and there are younger actors or newer actors, because I just think it's nice, even if you don't end up needing anyone, I think it's nice to say, if you do need someone, it'll be me. I'm here for whatever you need. So that was kind of the most important thing. They're all very self-sufficient. The younger cast of Yellow Jackets, they're like, we're good, thanks. But I think they appreciated like knowing that someone was looking out. And then also something I just have really noticed over the years, because I've been doing it for so long, is people don't really stick around for as long as like Leo has and Cate Blanchett has, unless they're nice. Mm-hmm. They're just good people. They're easy to work with. They're nice to the crew. I don't think I would be a person who would become mean if I was successful, but I don't think you can really overstate how important it is to be gracious to the people you're working with.
Well, I'll close by asking you about a big moment, which was your Critics' Choice win. I got emotional watching. What did that moment feel like? It felt emotional.
Oh my God, it was so crazy. It was so emotional. I mean, also, we've talked so much about my love for Critics. It could not be more meaningful for me that this group of people who I have such respect for voted. Also, like the other women in the category were just so amazing. I really did not expect it. I was very, very surprised. And so I just felt emotional at what it meant to me personally and what it meant for our show. And then halfway through my speech, I looked over and the whole cast of Yellow Jackets, like all the young people are just standing there like clutching their chests and crying. And I just was a wreck after that point. I just love them so much, and to feel their love in that moment, it was crazy. And you know, it's like a once in a lifetime thing. How lucky am I to have had that moment in my life? It was really so special.
Well, here's to a few more at least.
Well, if that's the only one, it was pretty magical, so I'm very grateful for that.
That does it for today's interview episode. We'll be back on Thursday with our regular roundtable conversation about all things Emmys and much more. In the meantime, find us at vanityfair.com and on Twitter at littlegoldmen. This week's episode was edited and produced, as always, by Brett Bukes.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.